The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, and I'm also going to read some information from AARP's newsletter about health conditions. And the first article comes from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, and it's called News and Our Views. No chemo for many women with breast cancer. According to a recent large-scale study called TAILOR-X, doctors can now more confidently recommend foregoing chemotherapy for many women with the most common type of early-stage breast cancer. The study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine and focused on about 10,000 women with breast cancer that was hormone receptor positive, human epidermal growth factor receptor, or HER2, negative, and axillary node negative. Cancer experts often use a gene expression test of a tumor to gauge the likelihood of cancer recurrence after surgery, and then recommend anti-estrogen therapy, chemotherapy, or both. Recurrence risk is scored from 0 to 100. Women with scores of 10 and below have a low recurrence risk and receive only anti-estrogen therapy. Women with scores over 25 have a higher recurrence risk, making it necessary to receive both anti-estrogen therapy and chemotherapy. The TAILOR-RX study focused on women with scores in the middle range of 11 to 25 and randomly assigned these women to a treatment of either anti-estrogen therapy alone or a chemotherapy with anti-estrogen therapy. There was very little difference in the rate of cancer recurrence and survival between the two groups 5 and 9 years later. Mayo Clinic experts say this study has already changed how patients are treated. In the past, doctors tended to err on the side of offering chemotherapy to women with a middle range recurrence score. But this study showed that about 70% of women with this type of breast cancer described above, including all those with low scores and most with mid-range scores, can likely be spared from chemotherapy. The next topic is heart failure risk and artificial intelligence. Again, this is in News and Our Views from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. The left ventricle provides most of your heart's pumping power. A decline in this pumping power, called left ventricular dysfunction, is a potential precursor to heart failure. Sometimes this decline occurs without causing any noticeable symptoms early on. This is a difficult-to-detect condition known as asymptomatic left ventricular dysfunction. It's present in an estimated 9% of older adults, and treating it can help prevent heart failure. New research from Mayo Clinic cardiologists published in Nature Medicine shows how artificial intelligence may increase the ability to accurately diagnose and treat the condition before heart failure can occur. A large set of electrocardiogram data was used to develop a type of artificial intelligence with which patterns could be recognized. A set of rules, also called algorithms, developed from this data, had a high level of accuracy in detecting people with left ventricular dysfunction, as confirmed by follow-up testing. Notably, one subset of study participants whose EKGs were flagged as abnormal by the algorithms were found to have normal ventricular function in follow-up testing. However, in the years after this false positive group was found to have a fourfold risk of developing future left ventricular dysfunction. This suggests that the algorithms may be able to detect very early abnormalities. While this use of artificial intelligence is not part of a standard medical practice, Mayo Clinic experts say it could one day be an easy, inexpensive screening tool for ALVD. Remember, that's asymptomatic left ventricular dysfunction, with the potential to reduce heart failure risk. Another short article from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter is entitled Resistance Bands, a Simple Way to Gain Strength. You'd like to try some strength training, but you're intimidated by dumbbells and weight machines at the health club, plus you'd like something you can do at home. If that's the case, you may want to try resistance bands or tubes, which are available at sporting goods stores, from online retailers, or in most gyms. They come in different tensions and are usually color-coded. They're much easier to transport and store than weights. Strength training can provide many health benefits, like better bone health, balance, and ability to perform everyday tasks like unloading groceries, carrying a suitcase, and mowing the lawn. Try to strength train at least twice a week, making sure to exercise all major muscle groups. The article goes on to suggest that you should check first. If you have health problems, talk with your doctor. Start slow. The Mayo Clinic experts say to start with one set of 10 repetitions or fewer for each exercise with a lower tension band. As you get stronger, make the exercises harder by doing more repetitions, like one or two sets of 10 to 15 repetitions, or progressing to a band with greater tension. Stay in control. Count to three as you push or pull the band where you want it to go. Hold it there for 1 second, then count to three as you ease back to the start. Don't thrust or allow the band to jerk back. Exhale during the most difficult part of the exercise and inhale during the less difficult part. If you need to tie the band in a loop, it's easier to untie if you use a shoelace knot. Now, once again from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, is an article entitled Improving Foot Pain, Finding the Perfect Shoe. To improve your fitness, you started taking daily brisk walks around your neighborhood. But after a few days, you can't continue. Your feet hurt, and you think you're developing a corn. How can you stay healthy if your feet hurt every time you try to exercise? As you age, changes to your body and feet can make foot pain more likely. This can make daily activities more difficult and even increase your risk of falls. However, foot pain is often avoidable by modifying or switching your shoes. As foot issues develop, seek medical attention. You may need to see a podiatrist, a doctor specializing in foot and ankle care, to get a prescription for special footwear or foot supports like orthotics. Still, much of managing and preventing foot pain can come down to proper footwear. Here's a look at some common challenges that occur with aging, along with footwear solutions. Your feet can change in size as you get older, usually getting wider and longer. Ask to have your feet measured, including the width, at a shoe store. Keep in mind that one foot can be slightly larger than the other, so you should buy for the larger foot. Wear the socks you would normally wear with the shoes, as this will affect the fit. Try shoes on near the end of the day, when your feet are at the largest. The natural fat pads on the bottom of your feet can thin over time, reducing the padding that absorbs the shock of steps. In addition, your arches may become lower, and you can develop flat feet. This can contribute to the development of foot pain, or pain around the inside of the ankle. solution. Supportive cushioned shoes with shock-absorbing outer soles can help cushion and protect your feet. It's best to limit heels to an inch or lower if you have foot problems. A semi-rigid, prefabricated, or custom-made shoe insert that provides arch support and cushioning may help improve pain. Podiatrists may recommend a brace to help stabilize the foot and ankle. Challenge: poor shoe quality. Shoes can be expensive, and it's tempting to select a low-cost shoe that doesn't fit great or provides minimal support. Wearing old, worn-out shoes that have quit providing support or tread grip can also be a problem in terms of foot health and safety. When buying shoes, opt for a stiff heel that doesn't give way when pressing on it, a toe box that's semi-flexible, and a shoe that does not twist in the middle when you try to twist it. Challenge: bumps or protrusions. These can be caused by hammer toes, corns, bunions, and bone spurs. Shoes that don't fit properly can further irritate bumps and protrusions by rubbing or pressing against them. Ill-fitting shoes, hammer toes, and bunions can also cause pain at the ball of the foot, which is called metatarsalgia. Solution: the front of the shoe, the toe box, should be roomy, with a half an inch between the end of your longest toe and the end of the shoe. Never buy shoes that are too tight. You can also have shoes professionally stretched in areas of irritation. For metatarsalgia, metatarsal pads or cushions may help ease impact on the affected joint, as can appropriate footwear. Risk of falls. Over 25% of adults 65 and older fall every year. Falls are a major cause of injury for seniors and can be fatal. Improper footwear is one factor that contributes to falls. So what's the solution? Avoid walking barefoot, in poor-fitting slippers, or in socks, as these have been linked with an increased risk of falls. Wear shoes with laces or straps, as these can keep the shoes from slipping off. Avoid flip-flops and backless sandals, and look for sturdy shoes with non-skid soles. Also, as you age, it can be difficult to get shoes on and off. A solution is to use elastic laces or Velcro straps, which allow you to slip shoes on and off without tying and untying. A long-handled shoehorn can also help. Now we're going to read about second opinions from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. The first question: I have a clogged heart artery. My doctor says it's stable and prescribed medications for it, but it still causes discomfort when I exercise, and I'm worried about having a heart attack. Should I ask about getting a stent? When one or more arteries supplying the heart with blood have narrowed, poor blood flow can result in ongoing pain or discomfort in your chest. Stable angina, which is chest pain, means the pain and discomfort are predictable, and the angina maintains generally the same pattern. The angina occurs with certain circumstances, usually with exercise, and is relieved by rest or with medication. It's true that under some circumstances, people with persistent, stable angina may be good candidates for stent placement, where a small mesh tube is placed in a narrowed artery to widen it, especially if they have more serious heart disease. However, for many people with mild to moderate heart disease, stable angina can be effectively treated with lifestyle change and daily medication. Even when stable angina persists, moving on to placing a stent isn't a surefire decision. Stent placement may reduce the frequency of chest discomfort immediately after the procedure, but it's unlikely to reduce your risk of a future heart attack or impact longevity. On the other hand, stents can be very effective in relieving symptoms if the angina is more severe or if medications aren't completely effective. After stent placement, you still need to take medicines regularly including anti-clotting drugs and aspirin, usually baby aspirin. There are also certain risks, though small, associated with stent placement. During the first few months after placement, a few people experience bleeding due to anti-clotting medications or occasionally develop a blood clot in the stent that leads to a heart attack. Some people may need another stent placed if the artery re-narrows. If you're considering a stent for stable angina, go over the pros and cons carefully with your doctor. If you opt for the stent, seek out a heart specialist who's experienced in performing the procedure and who operates at a hospital with a high volume of the procedure. Question: I used to consistently experience itching all over my body after meals. Then I started carefully reading nutrition labels and cutting food additives like artificial flavors and colors out of my diet, which seemed to help. Does this mean I'm allergic or sensitive to food additives? According to the FDA, food additives are any ingredient or substance like preservatives, vitamins, minerals, artificial sweeteners, antioxidants, spices, flavors, and colors that are added to food. All food additives must be approved by the FDA. This means the FDA has found that these additives meet its standard of reasonable certainty of no harm. It's common to confuse allergic reactions and intolerances. A food allergy causes an immune system reaction that affects numerous organs in the body. A food allergy can be severe or life-threatening and require immediate medical care. By contrast, symptoms of food intolerance are generally less serious and limited to digestive problems like nausea or cramping. It's possible to develop an intolerance, sometimes called a sensitivity, to a food additive, but this appears uncommon. There also have been rare reports of true allergic reactions, but it's more common to have an allergic reaction to foods like peanuts or seafood than a food additive. A few additives have more well-established associations with negative reactions. For example, sulfites, S-U-L-F-I-T-E-S, are used to preserve dried fruit, canned goods, and wine, and can trigger asthma attacks. The dye FDNC, yellow number 5, also known as tartrazine, T-A-R-T-R-A-Z-I-N-E, may rarely cause hives. The red food dye carmine and other additives have been linked to severe allergic reaction called anaphylaxis. Now I'm going to turn to an article that comes from the AARP newsletter about health conditions. This article is entitled, Seven Myths About Face Masks by Rachel Nanya. Face masks are everywhere. What were once reserved for hospitals and healthcare settings are now a common sight on sidewalks and in businesses throughout the country. Still, there are a number of misconceptions when it comes to masks. Here are seven common face mask myths busted. Myth one, you don't need to wear a face mask if you don't feel sick. This was the prevailing advice at the beginning of the pandemic, but not anymore. Experts have learned more about the coronavirus and how it spreads, and now the recommendation from the CDC is that everyone, including people who feel perfectly healthy, should wear a face covering in public settings where it may be difficult to maintain 6 feet of space from other people. Examples would be grocery stores, pharmacies, retail shops, hair salons, crowded parks, and more. The reason? It's an added layer of protection. The virus is thought to spread easily between people who are in close contact with one another by respiratory droplets produced when an infected person talks, coughs, or sneezes. And because some infected people might be pre-symptomatic or even asymptomatic, and as such are at risk of unknowingly spreading the virus to others, A face mask provides an extra layer to help prevent the respiratory droplets from traveling in the air onto other people, the CDC says. People who feel sick should stay at home and not venture out in public. That said, they should wear a face mask when interacting with family members or caregivers at home. Myth number two, everybody should be wearing surgical masks or N95 respirators. The advice from the CDC is the general public should wear cloth face coverings, but not medical-grade masks, which are best left for healthcare professionals on the front lines of the pandemic. The CDC-recommended covering can be purchased. Major clothing retailers like The Gap and Disney are selling them, sewn or fashioned from everyday household items like bandanas and rubber bands, even from socks. Myth number three, a loose-fitting mask works just fine. That's false. The key is to make sure your face mask fits snugly but comfortably against the side of the face, says the CDC, and completely covers the mouth and nose to help prevent respiratory droplets from escaping. That said, it's important to make sure you can breathe without restriction with the mask on. Myth number four, your cloth face covering protects you from getting coronavirus infection. Cloth masks may reduce your risk of getting infected, but there haven't been enough studies in real-world settings to know for sure whether they protect the wearer from becoming infected with the coronavirus, the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, or NASEM, reports. What's more likely is that cloth face coverings help prevent an infected wearer from spreading disease to others by minimizing the dispersal of respiratory droplets by talking, coughing, and sneezing. Even with a face mask on, it's important not to abandon other preventative measures like frequent hand washing and physical distancing, the CDC says. Mitigating the risk of COVID-19, the illness caused by the coronavirus, requires a multi-pronged approach, which includes social distancing and isolation and hygiene and wearing masks, says Gonzalo Behrman, MD, an associate hospital epidemiologist and chair of the Division of Infectious Disease at Virginia Commonwealth University School of Medicine. It's not one or the other, it's all of it. Myth five, babies should wear face masks. Children under two should not wear a face mask, the CDC says. Neither should anyone who has trouble breathing or is unconscious, incapacitated, or otherwise unable to remove the mask without assistance. Myth six, you should wear a face mask even when you swim. If you plan to head to the pool or the beach this summer, don't forget to pack your face mask. It will come in handy when you're out of the water and around others. That said, you should not wear a face mask in the pool. The issue of getting a mask wet, the issue of then breathing through the mask, it's a setup for danger, says Dr. Boris Lushniak, Dean of the University of Maryland School of Public Health. When you're in the water, the best way to reduce your risk of spreading or acquiring the virus is to keep a distance of at least 6 feet from other people and to wash your hands often when you're done swimming. Myth number seven, your face mask doesn't need to be washed. Masks collect germs, so it's important to wash them after every use, the CDC advises. If you're using a washing machine, regular laundry detergent and warm water works fine. To wash your mask by hand, mix a solution of bleach and water, 4 teaspoons of household bleach per quart of room temperature water, and soak the mask for 5 minutes before rinsing it with cool or room temperature water. I'll just briefly mention that the FDA has issued a voluntary recall on hand sanitizers, and the FDA goes on to state that methanol is not an acceptable ingredient for hand sanitizers and should not be used because of its toxic effects. Methanol, or wood alcohol, can be toxic when absorbed through the skin or ingested. One product that was recalled was Sanoderm Advanced Hand Sanitizer, packaged in 1 liter plastic bottles and labeled Made in Mexico. They go on to list several other hand sanitizers that have been recalled by the FDA. These include All Clean Hand Sanitizer, Biochem Hand Sanitizer, Clean Care No Germ Advanced Hand Sanitizer, Lavar 70 Gel Hand Sanitizer, The Good Gel Antibacterial Gel Hand Sanitizer, Clean Care No Germ Advanced Hand Sanitizer, and Sanoderm Advanced Hand Sanitizer. In response to COVID-19, the FDA reminds people to wash their hands using soap and water for at least 20 seconds, especially after going to the bathroom, before eating and after coughing, sneezing, or blowing the nose, to prevent the spread of coronavirus. If soap and water is not available, use a hand sanitizer that contains 60% ethanol, but not wood alcohol, to kill most disease-causing germs. Anything less than that may not work as well for many type of germs and could merely reduce the growth of germs rather than killing them outright, the CDC says. Hand sanitizer works best when used correctly. Apply enough to cover the entire surface of both hands. Rub the hand sanitizer into your hands, paying special attention to the fingertips until your skin is completely dry. It should take about 20 seconds. Well, it looks like we run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.